Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News Now, in depth on what we owe the addict as friends and family. That question wasn't academic to Sigrid Rousing. Her brother and sister-in-law were dangerously destructive with drugs, going in and out of rehab when they weren't in the depths of their addiction. Eva Rousing would die at 48. Sigrid Rousing writes of that loss in her new memoir. It made me think deeply about the nature of family and the limits of our responsibility for one another, who we were and who we had become. As Ms. Rousing joins us, I think your experience with this could shape our conversation and your ideas. If someone you love has been addicted or is in the midst of an addiction right now, how do you wrestle with where your responsibility for them begins and perhaps ends? Have you had to withdraw, turn away at one point because the addiction was too traumatic and too damaging for you and your family? So if you've been through this, you've dealt with the addiction of a loved one, a very close friend, someone in your family, have you given some thought to where your responsibility ends with them, the limits of your involvement and responsibility, and maybe some of your experience with that would inform the conversation. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Sigrid Rousing's new memoir is titled Mayhem, and she's with us today from London. And Sigrid, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Hi, Carrie. It's great to be with you.
The names and the circumstances, of course, of individual addicts are unique, and you note that in the memoir. Mm-hmm. But what you say about the predictable progress of the disease is so true. I mean, these stories mm-hmm. have such a powerful undercurrent of trauma and despair that starts to have a continuity across mm-hmm. people that have been involved with this. Tell me what you've been thinking about that.
Well, I think it's part of the real mystery and conundrum of addiction is the fact that the disease has a very predictable course, and so one begins to think of it not as a series of random events as it might have been if it had been just about nurture rather than nature, but rather I think of it as almost a sort of viral disease. You know, you go through the stages, and those stages are recognizable.
Recognizable from one person to the next, even though, of course,
yes.
the individual stories are different. I was thinking about that, and I thought, you know, and you will know this better than anyone, that when you're in the midst of being mm-hmm. of being with somebody who's addicted, loving someone mm. who's addicted, it feels like your own special hell, and that could anybody else have possibly gone through this the way you're going through this? Did it feel
yeah.
like that at times?
Yeah. And I think what made our situation and many other people's situation a particular form of hell was the fact that we eventually applied to gain custody of Hans and Eva's four children.
Mm-hmm.
So Hans and Eva, my brother and his wife, were both addicts, met in recovery. They were addicts when they were very young. Then they met in recovery, fell in love, got married, had four children. And the year 2000, they had a spectacular relapse that lasted for 12 years. And because that relapse came so late, you know, really they were in their mid-30s at the time. They had a whole life. You know, they had the four children, they had, you know, a house. Life was there. They were in the middle of life. And so the fact of the children made it impossible for us to walk away, as I think we otherwise would have done. You know, because we were already familiar with Families Anonymous and the groups, and you know, I do think that there is a very, very real limit to what you can do. But when there's children involved, of course, that becomes impossible. And so my particular definition of hell now is just thinking about that court case and thinking about, you know, the repeated hearings, the lawyers on both sides, the endless bundles and, you know, folders of paper. In fact, I had a big clearing of my office yesterday and cleared out boxes and boxes of this stuff and remembering, you know, the terrible nature of all that.
What I think is noteworthy and I thought really moving when you write about what it meant to make this decision to go in and petition for care of their of Hans and Eva's four children, you you don't write about this with I really think any sense of righteousness. I mean, and you and I think it would have been understandable if you felt very righteous about taking on this court case. Of course, Hans and Eva were devastated by the idea that they were going to lose their children. But you write about what an exercise of power this was and how uncomfortable you were with exercising that kind of power.
Yes. And I write about how it feels like not only an exercise, or not even primarily an exercise of power over the parents, but primarily, of course, it's an exercise of power over the children. You know, because these children were taken from their home and brought to our home. I mean, luckily, of course, we knew them very well and had spent, you know, many, many weekends and holidays and, you know, so, you know, it wasn't as though the children were going to strangers. But I think, you know, the issue of moving children from parents is terribly complicated thing to do, you know. And I think we must always recognize that power, both as individuals, and I also think the state needs to recognize its power, you know, and move very gently through it.
My question for our listeners here is, have you dealt with thinking about the limits of that power? And Heidi says on Twitter, yes, now that I'm a mom, protecting my kids comes first, even at the risk of hurting others. My kids are no longer allowed to see the addict. And to the phones here to Steve in Eden Prairie. Steve, it sounds like you have some experience with this.
Well, I do. My son, Max, died 2 years ago after 3 years of addiction.
I'm sorry.
And you know, to heroin. That was the end, heroin, but there were other drugs, many other drugs before that. And I experienced more harmful, more evil from my son as he struggled to survive this addiction. These theft and lies. And he was a beautiful, sensitive, loving young man. But when you have that kind of evil in your own family, and you struggle to help them, it is a feeling of total of hopelessness and despair. But there is hope. It always comes back until the end.
I'm so sorry to hear about your son. One of the things I write about in my book is that I'm sorry, the line has just been dropped, I think.
No, but I can hear
anyway,
you.
Anyway. Yeah. Okay. So one of the things I write about in my book is how help to the addict is not the same thing as we think of as help. So we think of helping the addict to get over the drug addiction. To the addict, drugs are the help. They are the medicine. And so they resist. They resist as much as they can any attempt to help them. And so, you know, the idea of what help is so problematic and so difficult.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because there's a part of the memoir where you talk about coming to understand how truly difficult and ultimately impossible it was for Eva to remain sober. And having to reckon with this idea that if only she would fill in the blank, right? Go to rehab and take it more seriously, mm-hmm. or just not indulge that need for drugs. And it sounds mm-hmm. like you come to understand that it was probably impossible for her, your sister-in-law who died at 48.
Yeah. I think it was. I think at that point when she died, she had a very weak heart. And she actually died not from heroin, but from a heart attack following crack cocaine inhalation. But she was in very poor shape, you know. And so I think at that point, both Hans and Eva were very, very reclusive. She'd actually managed to get herself to a rehab the week before she died. Then she came back to London. And this terrible thing happened. I think the behavior that you were talking about, you used the word evil, you know, the behavior of addicts when they are using and when they are, their backs are against the wall and they are so desperate and so controlled by this craving that they will do anything. I mean, there is a very real moral degradation that people don't talk about very much, you know, because one wants to be kind and compassionate and, you know, I think all one can do is be kind and compassionate. But, you know, it's the truth is family members go through absolute hell. And they're often told, you know, not to speak about it too much publicly because it's a terrifying thought that, you know, people in fragile recovery might you know, relapse or you know, there's this saying that everybody walks on eggshells around addicts. And that is really true.
Do you wish that you had been... I know you wrote Eva and Hans many, many letters. You've reprinted mm-hmm. some of the letters in the memoir. Mm-hmm. Do you wish you hadn't done so much eggshell walking with her?
I'm not sure I can answer that. I mean, we tried to do much more, but they, you know, towards the end, they wouldn't see us. So, you know, we were actually completely shut out of their lives. And I should say that I didn't do this alone. I did it with my husband and my sister and her husband, too. And my parents were somewhat involved as well. So, you know, do I wish that I'd been more robust? You know, maybe, because I feel like I knew, I should have known, because I was very involved in my brother's addiction when he was in his 20s, you know, a very long time ago. Mm-hmm. And I describe in the book how I ended up going to rehab myself because I was suffering from very bad depression. And the rehab where he had been sometimes took family members, and I was one of those family members. So I knew the whole world. I knew the world of addiction. And I'm still kind of shocked by how the force of denial, you know, one shapes one's worlds to one's own wishes, you know, one's own lenses, you know. So my brother, when we were in our early 20s, my brother had just come out of a rehab. He came to stay with me. I lived alone in London. All the signs were there. It was kind of, it would have been obvious to anyone that he relapsed straight away, but I didn't see it, you know, didn't want to see it, I think.
Call here from Daisy in Minneapolis. Hi, Daisy. What's your experience with this?
Hi, both of my parents were drug addicts, and I didn't grow up around addiction. My mom started using very young and stopped. Then we moved to the United States. I had a fairly normal childhood. And then my parents were reintroduced to it when I was about 11 years old. And my whole life changed. I had to leave my private school. We eventually lost our house and my grandparents took us in. My grandparents were extremely supportive of my parents throughout the whole thing, giving them money, sending them to rehab if they wanted to. And really what their final responsibility was, and what it took for both my parents to get sober, although my mom did die in a car accident while on prescribed methadone. But was my grandparents kicking them out and really letting them go and helping them hit rock bottom? And I think if they had continued to let them stay in the house and be supportive, the addiction would have continued.
I mean, I really do believe that, and I'm so sorry to hear about your mother. You know, tough love. Every addiction story is pivots around this issue of tough love versus unlimited love or enabling. You know, and the problem with unlimited love and always supporting, always forgiving, is that it can become very enabling of the addict. I have a bit of an issue with the concept of rock bottom because I think there are many different stages on that road. And I think the ultimate rock bottom, obviously, is death, you know. And I think it's so hard for parents. It's just unspeakably hard to see your children go through this. And one doesn't know what to do. You know, one of the themes of my book is really quite pessimistic because there is such a limit to what we can do, and we have to recognize that.
I'm glad you brought up this idea of rock bottom because I recently had a conversation about addiction that included one of our guests saying, in no other illness do we require people to hit rock, you know, be at the extreme if you've been diagnosed with cancer before we step in to intervene. It's an odd thing that has become just part of what we accept about how to think about addiction.
It's very odd, and it's linked to this idea that addicts have to want to get better, that has to be a free choice, volition. You know, but in fact, studies have shown that it makes no difference at all whether addicts are sentenced into care or voluntarily go into care. The outlook is more or less the same. And I think that that is a very, very important finding. And so, you know, I know in America it's not uncommon that addicts are sentenced into care. In Britain, it's very uncommon. It's very rare. Though it did happen to my brother. And I think, you know, sometimes I think of addiction almost as a form of extremism, you know. And so you have to be de-radicalized, as it were. You know, I trained as an anthropologist. And so I think of addiction as very much a culture as well as a disease. And I think, you know, in care what happens is you get better, and it's a therapeutic process, but you also de-radicalized. And what had become normal, you know, a situation that was normalized to do with drug dealers, a certain way of life, no longer seems normal. And you're able to walk away from it. Because the physical addiction isn't that powerful, even with heroin. You know, you can get over that in a week. This is a powerful emotional syndrome, and it's emotions that feeds the craving.
If you've just joined the conversation, just maybe turned on the radio here, I'm having a conversation with Sigrid Rousing. Her new memoir is called Mayhem, and we've dug in a bit on one of the key questions at the center of the memoir, which is where our responsibility as the loved ones, the friends, the family of people who are caught in addiction, where that begins and also the where it ends. I mean, Sigrid asks, you know, what are the limits of that responsibility? And so we're examining that this morning, and I'm asking you if someone you love has been addicted or in the midst of an addiction right now, how do you wrestle with where your responsibility for them begins and maybe ends? And have you had to withdraw, turn away, because the addiction was too damaging to you, maybe to your family, maybe to your children. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at Carrie NPR, and to the phones to Marie in Minneapolis. Hi, Marie.
Hi.
Thanks for waiting.
Absolutely. Yeah, so my roommate used to be an alcoholic, and she had a series of unfortunate events that kind of brought her to that place. And one of my biggest issues I encountered was, driving her places or picking her up from places or knowing that she was drunk and that she was not safe to drive or take care of herself. And wondering, should I do this for her? Should I not? Because is this enabling or is this not? Right. And the thing with her is that she was so highly functional and people really couldn't realize that she was drunk. So I know that she would drink all day long at work. And she's just like this enthusiastic, fun-loving, outgoing person. And so I would, be driving home from work and think, well, I wonder if she's drunk right now and if I should pick her up on my way home or... I know she's going to a party. Do I need to go pick her up before she comes back? And I was willing to let her, crash her car and suffer those consequences, but I wasn't willing to let her crash her car and harm someone else as a result. So it was always this question for me, like, am I, by not enabling her, putting somebody else in harm's way because other people aren't realizing that she's this highly functional drunk?
Yeah.
I'm
glad to hear that. I mean, those are impossible choices, Marie, right? It's a very difficult calculation to make. Sigrid, I'm sure that sounds familiar to you in dealing with Hans and Eva at times.
Oh, so familiar. I mean, I think one of the things that people think is that there are clear moral choices and you want to be a good person and you want to do the right thing, but as you say, the thought that your roommate might crash her car and kill or harm other people is kind of unbearable. So, what do you do in that situation? Sometimes there are no good choices and I think... in the end, it's a continuous conversation. And sometimes, especially if you're young, it's helpful to involve other people in that conversation because there are people out there who can help you have the conversation.
I think we should explain, since you're speaking to an American audience here, that the tabloid press was very interested in what was going on with Hans and Eva. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is that you come from a very wealthy family, mm-hmm. and Eva, mm-hmm. am I correct in this? Eva also had her mm-hmm. own money, and they lived a very mm-hmm. social existence in London.
Yes, they did, yes. Yeah.
And so when you would see these stories in the tabloid mm-hmm. press, mm-hmm. well, you've written about shame and what dealing with the shame of this. What was that like?
Yeah, and I think, particularly in the internet age, those stories will follow us always, I looked up my sister the other day, how you never look up your siblings. So I looked up my sister, Lisbeth Rousing, and she's a very solid citizen. She has a PhD from Harvard, she's written a book, she's very philanthropically engaged, she does great things. Half of the entries on her first page are all about my brother and drug addiction.
Wow.
And it's the same for me. It's the same for my father. And, of course, my father was also, because parents are so implicated often in the course of addiction, often unfairly, because I do think, all the evidence seems to show that there is a familial aspect of this. So, in other words, alcohol addiction, we know for sure, is 50, 60, 70% inherited. People use different figures. But there's a strong genetic component. With drug addiction, we think that there's a genetic component to it, but the evidence is not, there's not as much evidence because, the evidence for alcohol addiction was the twin studies that started in Scandinavia and in Sweden, in fact, which had excellent records of twins taken into care. So going back to the tabloids, you know, I there were so many stories about Hans and Eva in the papers. The stories always got something wrong, you know, so it was a slightly distorted picture. When Eva died, of course, you know, that just exploded everywhere in Britain and America, and Sweden in particular. And so, you know, part of writing this book is thinking about and trying to find a language for a story that was so public, and trying to, you know, think about how you express the grief that we found and the universality that we talked about before, you know, the universality of this story, and then the very particular components of this story. And it was a kind of, you know, there were choices on every page, you know, what do I put in, what do I take out?
I'm sure.
You know, there are many, many different drafts, and, you know, so it was a very interesting process, but it wasn't easy, and it hasn't been easy to publish the book either.
I understand Eva's father is quite unhappy about the publication.
Yes. He's very unhappy, and he was very much on the, you know, what we would call the enabling side of things, and he would call the unlimited love side of things. You know, he was very, very engaged in the addiction, and about 2 weeks before the book was published, he issued a press statement attacking the book, also attacking me, and really claiming that the fact that we took the children, that we instigated a court case to take the children, that hastened Eva's death. And so, you know, and he said many things in the press statement. He said, you know, that it's a very negative portrayal of Eva, which I don't really think it is. And actually, I felt closer and closer to Eva as I was writing the book.
Sigrid, I think you can read, not knowing you or you know, your relationship with your sister-in-law, I think it's clear you loved her and you anguished over what was happening with her.
Thank you for saying that. So his press statement, of course, you know, became its own huge thing, you know, and you know, if he had wanted people not to read my book, or if he'd wanted not to draw attention to my book, it was not the right thing to do.
Because now everybody's covering this, huh?
Yes, but I have to say, it was kind of awful to see it. It really was.
Emily says on Twitter, she notes that one of our callers said that hope returns. She says, my experience after 20 plus years, you're exhausted. Hope doesn't return. You step back to protect yourself. And to David in Maplewood, David, it sounds like you're in the midst of this with someone you love who's addicted. Is that right?
That is correct. I'm currently in the court system.
And are you in the court system to get custody of your children, or?
I have no children. They're both out of the house, but my wife has isolated herself from everybody. And anybody that mentions my name, she takes off of Facebook or instantly. So she's gone into a state of depression over the last 2 years, which I've seen increase. And her alcohol content has gone up to about almost $100 a week in alcohol. And I got all this evidence against it, and I do have an attorney. And he basically says that right now they have an order against me to stay away from her because of an incident that happened to me on July 4th.
But, David, it sounds like with this isolation, you're at this point you're kind of past the point of being able to help her. And maybe you just have to.
No, I don't believe that's the case. I do have family members helping her now, and a psychologist, and some of other family members. So I have people behind her now. I had talked to Al-Anon, and I basically flooded her Facebook page with friends of mine from all around the world, which Al-Anon told me to do. So I flooded her Facebook page with all these people that tried to be friends with her just to find out how she was and how she was doing.
Sigrid, let me ask you, because we're a little short on time, and David, forgive me for cutting you off, but I didn't want to miss what he said about the isolation, and I know that's something that was a factor with Hans and Eva. They kind of created their own world.
Yes, they did create their own world, and they were very, very reclusive towards the end. I wanted to go back to the idea of hope, you know, because I write in my book that hope keeps you going, but it also is the kind of terrifying aspect of this. Because as long as there's hope, you're sucked into the addiction, you know. And also to your last caller, you know, this is an illness where emotions run very high. And suddenly things can become crazily hostile. In a way that you never, ever might have expected to have had in your life, you know. It's been for me a very surreal experience.
Sigrid, how do you think about the fact that Hans and Eva's four children may want to eventually read this account? And as I said, I think it's a loving, anguished and seems to me very honest account, but no matter what, it has that moral depravity kind of dimension to it.
Yeah.
How have you thought about that?
Actually,
they have.
They have, yes, and my own son has read it too. And I, you know, it's been so interesting. They all read it in galleys, so they read it before it was published. They all had their own take on it. Every child reacted differently. Part of their feelings is, of course, fear of the tabloids raking this all up again. And, you know, that fear was not unfounded, unfortunately, you know, because it is all over the papers again. Nevertheless, I think in the long run, I think it would be very good to have this account.
Why?
Because it will give them something that isn't the tabloid's version of it. And the tabloid version of it was so ugly and so distorted and so sneery and so snide and unpleasant. What I'm trying to do in my book is to show that there's something deeper going on, that the parents still love their children, that there was love, that drug addiction is something that you cannot control. But I also wanted them to see that it's possible to think about things and to try and find a language for what happens, and that thinking about things and talking to therapists and, you know, writing down what you're thinking, it is a very good thing, because you come out the other side. You come out somewhere else.
Sigrid, a real pleasure for me to have a chance to talk to you about your memoir. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Carrie. It's been a pleasure.